but it was annoying. I mean, I was telling somebody, I was in DC in front of 400 people, and they said, look, this cookie is really terrible. I can't believe you guys are doing this. And I said, look, why don't someone in the audience come up and explain how they've had a personal problem from cookies? They lost a job, they lost some money, they did something. No one steps up.
Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
Hello and welcome to Paleo EdTech. I'm Marty Kine.
And I'm Jill Royce. And we are the hosts of this podcast that looks at the first two decades of advertising and marketing technology.
From double click to double verify and everything in between.
Get your name out there.
So we're very happy to welcome Kevin Ryan to the show. Kevin is the founder and CEO of Alicorp, which is a VC fund that started around 2008. And he is a prolific founder and co-founder of companies such as Gilt, Business Insider, and MongoDB, the latter with Dwight Merriman, who is the co-founder of DoubleClick, with Kevin O'Connor, who was our guest a few weeks ago. Indeed, Kevin Ryan himself, the other Kevin, as some people call him, was one of the first members of the DoubleClick team and was there from 1996 through 2005 as president and then CEO, which was a very dramatic time in the arc of the industry and of that company. So I like to start with a random personal question, which isn't that personal really, but I've heard that you have some kind of relationship with the Dilbert comic strip. What was that?
Yeah, it actually was a very fundamental relationship in my career. 96, I was working for a division of EW Scripps called United Media, and we owned the rights to Dilbert. And so I launched, as part of that, a website, and it became a very successful website, mostly because Dilbert fans were technology oriented. This was pre-browser, so it was hard to get there. And so anyway, this website became very successful. We sold advertising and was e-commerce enabled, which was harder than you would think at the time. And so I went to the parent company and said, I want to expand and we should build a big internet division. And they were not convinced. And so then I thought, okay, now that I've been thinking about this, I actually think the internet's going to be one of the most important things in my lifetime. And I should go do this full time. And so my idea was then to go out and start an internet company. And I went out to meet the five companies that existed in New York, just to understand the lay of the land.
All five of them.
No, it was tiny. It's hard for people to remember that there were no people working in startups in 1996 in New York. And I met Kevin O'Connor and Dwight at DoubleClick, and they said, why don't you come join us? We have a, you know, it's early stage, 12-person company, 15-person company, become CFO for a couple of months and then president, and the rest is history. Then I was there for the next 9 years and had an amazing career-altering experience.
So did you find the DoubleClick team or did they find you? How did that work out?
I reached out to them because we needed to sell advertising. And so I sold a couple of ads myself and realized that was not very scalable. And so there were two companies, as the predecessor of 24/7 and DoubleClick, that were selling advertising.
So where did the meeting with Kevin and Dwight take place?
At the DoubleClick office on 20, which at that, it moved many times, but at 23rd Street. I came away persuaded that, well, I was already persuaded the internet was going to be big. And I thought, if this doesn't work, I'll just join another internet company. And I liked Kevin and Dwight. And so I thought, let's try it. And then, you know, to think that 4 years later, we had 2,000 employees in 25 countries and a market cap of $13 billion. And obviously none of us had any idea how to do that. Both Kevin and I had managed like 50 people in our life at that point.
What were your skills at the time?
Oh yeah, no, I'd come up the finance side. I had been an investment banker for 4 years. And then I switched over to work with finance at Disney, then worked operations, and then became the COO of this division, of this 180 person company. So I was managing a 50, 60 person team, but more operational business oriented. And the two of them, you know, had real technical backgrounds. And so I was the business person out of the three of them.
Did they then offer you a job? They're like, oh, we got a job for you here, Kevin.
Yeah. Why don't you come join? Because on their side, they ran across very few people who had spent even 1 month in the internet at that place at that time. So I was a veteran, having spent the last 6 months, you know, working on a website, selling advertising, stuff like that. In fact, I met them 25 years and 4 months ago. And, you know, I spoke to Dwight last week, and Dwight and I have been partners for 25 years. And then Kevin, I'm an investor in Kevin's, he has a fund that he invests in. And so, you know, we still all have great relationships.
What number employee were you?
Somewhere between 12 to 15.
Now, obviously, you believed in the mission because you joined them. Yeah. But did you have a sense that it would grow so quickly?
No, I don't know that any company in the history of New York City had gotten to 2,000 employees after 4 years. So it wasn't even something that you could possibly imagine.
This was New York, as you mentioned. There weren't a lot of startups. What was it like trying to raise venture capital in those days?
So one of the challenges that doesn't exist anymore is that San Francisco investors generally would not invest in companies that were in New York City. If you weren't within, 40 miles of their office, they just didn't do it. And that they had to change over time because there's so many successful companies in New York. But so we got turned down by a lot of people there.
But why did that prejudice exist? They just felt the talent wasn't in New York.
Yeah, they couldn't see New York as there's always been a huge bias that New York can't create technology companies. It can only be done out there. That's one thing. The second thing, which is valid, and I have a big bias towards investing in companies in New York City. And the reason is we can add a lot more value. If you need a head of product, we know 100 people and know 5 people in San Francisco. We're not going to meet with you as frequently. You can't just stop over. There's just so many advantages. VC is early stage VC. When you're building a company, should be a mostly local business. So Boston was the center of VC on the East Coast, which is now moving to New York City. And so Greylock and Bain Capital came in and did what at the time was an enormous round for us about 6 months later, $35 million, buying out some of our existing shareholders. And we got very lucky because Dave Strum and Mark Nunnally were our board members and are two of the most brilliant board members I've ever worked with.
When DoubleClick started, it was like an ad network, basically. It sold media. But there was also, Dwight was busily developing a technology product. I guess you wouldn't call it SaaS. It would get early SaaS. So it was using the version of SaaS.
DoubleClick doesn't get credit for this. I think it was the first true SaaS product. Because think of what, we have a centralized server that, in fact, a lot of people said no to us because they said, you can't serve an ad on a site in Alaska in time to make that work. It's just not possible. If your servers are thousands of miles away. Think about it, there was no one else doing that. So I think we were the first. The word SaaS didn't exist. It was a big technical challenge that only Dwight could solve. And, he did. And so what really happened is that the initial tool of the company was not ad sales. The initial tool was ad serving. And Dwight and Elliot said, what do we use this for? And the answer was, we'll sell people's ads and create an ad network and have our own centralized system to do it. So it was a technology company from day one. But the product was a media product that people bought. And then what happened was about 6 months later, the Wall Street Journal, I think, called me, maybe Kevin, and said, we don't want you to sell our ads, but we keep hearing in the marketplace from all our ad buyers that your system is much better, the reporting is much better. So can we use your system and not have you sell the ads? And so we thought all revenue is good revenue. This wasn't part of our plan, but why not? At least when we sold the company, they were still using us 9 years later. And so we started doing that. And then 2 years later, we actually went into the board and we thought it was going to go maybe very badly as a publicly traded company and said, we think we should get out of the business that currently produces 90% of our revenues. So how many times have you read that article? Never. And really focus on ad technology because it's going to be a much better business. And it turns out that actually we were right. There is no super valuable ad network today doing what we did. You just can't make money on it. It's too hard. And ad technology is scalable and a great business. And DoubleClick today, I bet would be worth $20 billion, $30 billion if it were an independent company.
That was a very big strategic insight. So when you decided to focus on the technology, who made that decision? What was the business strategy?
All these things were collectively, the three of us and the management team. But Kevin was the CEO, so has to get, the ultimate credit for the call. What we could see, and we were right, is that we were doing hundreds of millions of dollars of ad sales and still not making money. Once our clients got big, they wanted to take ad sales in-house. It was easy. If we missed the numbers by 5%, it was so easy for them to say, oh my God, DoubleClick's terrible. When they missed the numbers by 5%, they'd be like, oh, the market's difficult, has nothing to do with us. We'd get thrown under the bus the whole time. But the technology business is, once you've installed it and you're doing it and you have thousands of campaigns running and it works, you really don't want to switch that. So many things can go wrong. It's like I said to you, oh, I have a pacemaker I want to put in that replace your current pacemaker. It better be much better because I don't like the idea of switching.
That It's a good analogy. So to go back to the IPO, so at a certain point you IPO'd, what was the impact that that IPO had on the business?
It was actually helpful for us because even though we were a B2B business, for people who were in New York at the time, DoubleQuick was a very, very well-known company. We were by far the most valuable New York-based company. We did a great job on PR. That was beneficial. People knew about us. People thought we were a cool company. We hired a lot of great, great people. You know, 34 people from DoubleClick eventually became CEOs.
It's known as the DoubleClick Mafia.
You spend time with your family?
Sure I do.
Good. Because a man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was probably the first, you know, business tech mafia, certainly in New York, and is a real thing. I mean, all of the, you know, MongoDB, which is worth $32 billion, is all the three of us are ex-DoubleClick people. So the IPO was very helpful. More people wanted to join. The people who were there were happy. You know, there was, for people in New York at the time, they knew that DoubleClick had a great culture. And, you know, people were really happy working there. Now, I'm not saying it was perfect, but I still have people come back and say, you know, it's 20 years later, and that was still the best professional experience of my life.
There was the kid in the hall, right?
Exactly. Brad Bender, yeah.
Brad Bender.
who's a senior exec at Google now.
So in terms of the culture you mentioned, and I recall I was in New York at the time, and I did want to work at DoubleClick. I was unqualified, but I certainly wanted to, like everyone else. DoubleClick welcomes you to Silicon Alley. The PR was tremendous. And also the parties were legendary at the time.
Yes.
What can you tell us about anything about the parties?
Halloween was really my thing. I always have thought that Halloween is a fun, if everyone dresses up, everyone always has a great time at Halloween. And so we would go into the office and you had to wear a costume. And we put enormous peer pressure on people to do that. We also had, you know, at the time there was probably more spending by all these companies, including our own, than there should have been. On the other hand, you know, we did a party for our clients where we had 2,000 people at the Roxy, you know, a huge nightclub. And I remember walking around, you know, here I am like 37, thinking, oh my God, people were flying in from London saying they wanted to come to this party for an ad technology company. We definitely had captured something that, you know, did cost money. I remember we spent $200,000 on that party. But on the other hand, you know, we grew to $500 million in revenue in 4 years. And I think back when now everyone is more conservative and more cautious, which is generally good. But on the other hand, we had a certain chutzpah and, you know, at the time that I think did pay off in many ways.
You also had that famous office that had a basketball court.
Yeah, I might have been quite responsible for that. We walked into the building on 33rd Street, which was the old Sky Rink. It's the only ice skating rink in New York that was on the, whatever, 18th floor or something. And no one would rent it because it was literally, there was still a Zamboni there when I saw the space. And so everyone passed because they're like, oh, it's too weird. But actually the office, the reason it was so interesting is that think of the advantage of a rink is that there are no columns. And so I built a deck like bunk beds that was another floor that we didn't have to pay for. So I built space for 140 people that we did not pay rent for because it was per square foot on the core, which made the whole space incredibly inexpensive and very cool looking. And then I took some of that extra money we had saved and built a basketball court and a gym there, which was super fun. I mean, look, we had a lot of people in their 30s who were still playing basketball. I mean, had fun.
So where was the court? Was it literally on the roof?
There were huge terraces on each side. And so one terrace we kept, which as a side note is where we watched the two twin towers come down because we could see them from our office on 33rd Street. And the other one we built into it. It was a perfect size for a basketball court, full court basketball.
Okay. How was your game?
I was a okay high school player. So, you know, competitive with most people, unless they were a college player. I was recruited for college in soccer. So I'm a better soccer player, but I actually have a basketball court in my house in New York.
Get your name out there.
NetGravity was a major acquisition that you made, you know, an on-premise ad server. What was the thinking behind the NetGravity acquisition?
We were the number one player in ad technology. They were the number two player. So lots of incentives to bring that together. And we had, you know, the SaaS product, centralized system. They had a software product. So there were certain people who still didn't trust SaaS systems, wanted to make sure they controlled all the data, a bunch of big customers. So it made sense to bring them both together. And I think that was it was expensive, but okay for us, made sense, and consolidated the business. And, you know, when there's a perception in the industry that you are just the default player and the unquestioned leader, that can be helpful. And so I think it worked out well. I don't know, in retrospect, we may have paid too much for it, but everything was expensive at the time, but it was definitely helpful for us. And, you know, the reason that DoubleClick today, even though it's a division of Google, is the number one player 25 years later is, I think, because of two reasons. One is no one could build faster than we did. You know, to open 25 countries in your first 4 years before your first country is even profitable is a bold, bold move. And we did that, which meant that a lot of customers, if you're a Procter & Gamble or Microsoft, you need the same ad serving in, you know, 25, 50 countries in the world. And our competitors could only offer it in 6 countries. We had 25. So you went with us. We were the global player that could support a global player. And then if you're a smaller player and you say, oh, well, Procter & Gamble and IBM and all these guys are using DoubleClick, we probably should too. So it was a combination of moving very quickly and you know, losing money and building up the infrastructure, and the acquisition of NetGravity just cleared the way for us. And the other thing is that the third thing that we really did, and this is completely due to Kevin and Dwight, is product innovation. I mean, most things that were created, you know, in the first 15 years of the internet in ad technology were actually created by DoubleClick. Yeah. And really, you know, focused on that. If the two of us, I focused on sort of running the business, hiring, firing, you know, opening new offices, Wall Street, stuff like that. And he focused a lot on product innovation, you know, with Dwight, and, you know, invented almost everything. When you look at retargeting today, I remember the meeting when those guys came out and said, you know what, we think we can do retargeting. And which is now a multi-billion dollar business, but I remember the meeting. And so those guys, both of them are really, really good at that.
What was your response to the retargeting idea?
Oh, it seemed like a fantastic idea. You know, it's, by the way, retargeting has been a little bit abused today and can annoy people, but
it works.
You know, in the case we were thinking, the car industry was a big early advertiser. And, you know, for 2 years, you're not interested in cars. Then for 30 days, you start looking at car sites because you're like, oh, which SUV should I get? And how do we reach you during that zone? And so even reaching you on a sports site, which is not very valuable, but if we can give you a car ad to that person who's been on the new car, you know, buying page on another website, is a fundamentally great idea. You just have to make sure it's not, what I don't like now is it's too creepy. You look at one sweater, and then on 12 sites in a row, they 10 seconds later.
So yeah. Another acquisition that was done was Abacus, obviously famous acquisition. What was the thinking there?
Well, Abacus was an incredible business, data cooperative, where every single catalog in the world really gave their data to Abacus, and in return could buy names and expand. And what it turns out that even though you and I may have exactly the same demographics, our purchase history will show that you buy gardening stuff and I buy, you know, kids' clothing. And the purchase behavior tells you exactly what you're going to buy in the next 6 months. That's not going to switch. And so they had that, worked very well, very profitable. And so we want to do the same thing online. That's what just made sense. All we're trying to do is say, look, if you buy gardening things on one website, it would be useful and we can target you elsewhere. And by the way, that's what Facebook does today. That's what Google does today. We were ahead of our time, and people were nervous about privacy. They were nervous about cookies, even though no one's really been hurt by a cookie. They were nervous about it. So the FTC got upset, started an investigation. And so we decided we couldn't do that politically. We lost that PR war against an enemy that no one could identify. It was so vague. And so we knew ultimately this was all going to happen, and it has happened. But we were the tip of the spear and got hurt.
Yeah, Kevin O'Connor described it as, he said, there really were no rules. The rules were being made up as time went on. He ended up leaving the company, and because he said, the way he described it is, he said, you actually liked dealing with the regulators more than he did. Is that how you remember it?
Well, like it is a strong word. Like it more than he did, yes. You know, no one likes it. He definitely has a short temper for those sort of things. Sure. And so it was better for me to be the face of that in that process. But it was annoying. I mean, I was telling somebody, I was in DC in front of 400 people, and they said, look, this cookie's really terrible. I can't believe you guys are doing this. They said, look, why don't someone in the audience come up and explain how they've had a personal problem from cookies? They lost a job, they lost some money, they did something. No one steps up.
That's still the situation. So it hasn't changed much.
Yeah. No.
So then you were there for the crash. You were a victim, I guess, just like everyone else, of the 2001 market crash. What was the impact of that on DoubleClick?
So I would say, don't forget, it was actually worse for us than for the other consumer companies, because our clients were all the businesses that went under. So during 2.5 years, we lost about 70% of our clients. So literally every quarter, I was the CEO now, every quarter, 50 clients would call up and say, oh, Kevin, by the way, I know we're shutting down. And remember when I told you that 200,000 that we owe you is coming? It's not coming. A barrage of negativity. We didn't know when it was going to end. So we did a round of layoffs and then another round of layoffs and another one and another one, another one. So, we went from 2,000 people to 1,000 people through layoffs and sales. Everyone in 2000 thought that, you know, Kevin and I were utter geniuses, both internally, externally, anywhere. And then 2 years later, we're pretty convinced we're utter idiots. Like, why didn't you see this crash coming? And so our stock price went from $130 a share to $5. By the way, don't do that if you're taking notes. It turns out investors don't really like it. And so it's a hard process. No one wants to go through that.
Get your name out there.
I never lost faith that the fundamentals were working. And so what was interesting is that if you said, let me just see the core data of DoubleClick, like how many ads are you serving? How many ads are people seeing? How many people are clicking on ads? That number went up the entire time. And then so that was going up and our stock price was going down. So part of it is because the stock price was just too high. It should never have been worth $13 billion. And part of it is because people overreacted.
Well, it was a bubble.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no bubble today. And a bubble, definitely a bubble, is when the whole industry goes down by like 80%. If the industry goes down by 25%, that's market, normal volatility. It happens quite a bit. Khrushchev once said, in the famine, the fat get thin and the thin die. So we were the fat that got thin and all the thin ones died. So it wiped out 80% of our competitors. And we had done one thing that was either lucky or smart, is we raised $800 million. I went on the roadshow in 2000 and raised $800 million. So there was no chance of us going bankrupt. And then I could use that, in a sales pitch, if I'm competing against you, I would just say to the guy, look, I mean, he's got $15 million in the bank. He might make it. I mean, who knows? We're going to be here. And you're installing a tool that you need to be there for 7 years. And five other players who are about his size went bankrupt and screwed all of their clients because they just call up one day and say, oh, yeah, your ads don't work anymore. And so that's why we did better than everyone else and came out of it with like 65% market share in the world.
So your margins were improving. And at a certain point in 2005, you sold to private equity, Hellman Friedman. How did you make that decision?
Dwight, Kevin, and I didn't really want to sell the company. And we were right. We could see that the internet had turned around, that things were getting better. It was still taking a time to flow through. Stock prices were up a little bit, but not a lot. So we had signed some huge clients that were starting to increase volume. On the other hand, our board members, who were super smart, it wasn't they just got this wrong, that they'd been on the board for 9 years. The VCs had distributed their shares, so they had no skin in the game. And at a certain point, you're like, our stock was undervalued. What if we got a 50% premium? We should sell the company. And they did. We were also Kevin had retired. I was bored of running an ad tech company. I didn't really want to do it. I thought it was undervalued, but I didn't want to do it just intellectually anymore. I wanted to do other things. And so we were all ready to do something else. And so sold it. And Hellman Friedman bought the company. And I remember 2 weeks before thinking that I had no idea who was going to be the ultimate bidder because people can change their price. But the firm that deserved to win was Hellman and Friedman. They're the people who understood the business the best, had done great research, had smart people. So didn't matter to us, but the right player won.
Were you happy about the price?
Not in the long term. No, I mean, look, it's 50%. No, but I mean, 50% premium to your stock price before we announced the sale, everyone would tell you, look, you got to take that. I mean, you have to. We certainly believed that long term, it was going to be much more valuable than that.
And you were right.
And it was going to take years. On the other hand, I want to point out that many people in management teams think that, and they're not always right. Jerry Yang and the whole team turned down the Microsoft offer. They had a big premium. They were wrong.
Famously wrong.
Famously wrong. But it wasn't, it wasn't obvious.
You said you were bored running an ad tech company. Why was that? Is it the industry itself?
It was more that I'd been doing the same thing for 9 years, call after call of ad technology. At a certain point, there's only so many things you can do. You're in a narrow industry. I never wanted to spend my whole career doing that. And I have made a point of, since selling DoubleClick, I have never had a 1 hour meeting about ad technology. I don't touch it. It's a version of, I've used this example before. My father worked in a chocolate factory during college to make money for 6 months. And he's never eaten chocolate again because he smelled it 7 hours a day for 6 months. And it ruined chocolate for him forever. And I was, arguably, since Kevin was retired, I was the number one person in ad technology in the world in 2005. And so people would come to me and say, why don't you, we'll back you to start a new, ad tech company. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to do it. And so I've done 50 different things, which are intellectually interesting. I started a company in meth addiction, in psychedelics, in, weddings, in business media, in databases, but none of them are ad technology.
What is your attitude toward advertising today, would you say, in general?
That it's a part of the ecosystem. It's working. It should be part of it, and it's just a tool that no one's ever loved it. I also got tired of defending, advertising to everyone for 9 years, because it's not like I wake up every day and I think, oh my God, advertising is the greatest thing ever. It's just a tool that people need to have. I mean, if I said, do you want the New York Times every day at $5 an issue, or do you want to pay $2 and have advertising? Everyone's like, actually, I'll take $2.
Why did you bring 3 bananas?
Because I don't trust the advertising. I'm naturally suspicious.
The only people who really feel a fondness for advertising are people like me who worked in agencies for a while and sort of got to know creatives.
But the truth is that online advertising is just less creative and less interesting, because you just generally don't have the, until we had real video ads, which we didn't have much of at the time. It's not that interesting.
It's hard to feel excited about a banner. Google eventually obviously bought DoubleClick. What changes did the PE make to prepare for sale?
They just did a good job. David Rosenblatt, who'd been on our team for 9 years, took over. Dwight and I wanted to go on and do other things. We didn't want to stay. So David did a fantastic job. He's the CEO of First Dibs now, and a great manager and operator. And so they really just tightened everything up. What helped them a lot is the industry started growing. Money came back in, sites were growing. At that point, when you're that big, you are really a reflection of the market. And so if the market grows, you're in great shape. 50% of the market and the market's shrinking, there's really nothing you can do.
Yeah.
One challenge is that we ran out of market. Once you have 50 or 60% of the market, you can't grow anymore, because it's part
too
of the
dominant.
Remaining 40, you're too dominant. So you have to go into other products and sell things. And some of those worked and some of those didn't work, but nothing worked as well as our original core business.
What were you excited about after in the post-DoubleClick era?
A wide variety of things. We started Gilt, Business Insider, and Mongo are 3 companies that we started in 2007. We also started some companies like ShopWiki and Panther Express that did okay, but not great. So not everything worked, but a lot of things really did work. And that 2007 year was amazing. And we had 3 very, very, very successful companies.
Well, how did you come up with three such different ideas in this short period of time? I mean, was this a long dinner meeting where you brainstormed?
Mongo was more the creation of Dwight and Elliot, who are deeply technical, who are incredibly brilliant. We all knew that there was an opening to compete against Oracle, and it's in a colossal industry. They deserve more credit for that than I do. Business Insider was more my idea, and Gilt was my idea, although Dwight was an investor in both of those. He spent most of his time on Mongo, and I spent most of my time on the other two, but I was chairman of all 3.
Get your name out there.
And then finally, you mentioned you were at Burning Man. Do you get business ideas there?
No, I wouldn't say that. You listen to great music, amazing people, great atmosphere. There's an intangible to what I love about Burning Man is that it's only 4 days of the year, 5 days that I'm completely off the grid. Normally my day is, like many people's, unbelievably structured. I think I have, 10 separate meetings today. So there's hardly 5 minutes to spend time thinking about anything. And for 5 days, your phone doesn't work. You have no schedule. You don't know what's going on. There's a liberating process that I really, really enjoy that is a recharge. I can't point to something very specific that I came up with a brilliant idea there, but I think it's part of general mental health that is valuable.
Looking back at the DoubleClick episode of your life, which was lengthy, almost 10 years. What are your memories, impressions?
Incredibly positive. I mean, it was so formative for me. For me, it set up my entire career, because what I felt like I had was 40 years of business experience compressed into 9 years. So before that, no one had, gone from 0 to 2,000 people, international, meeting with 1,000 brands, going public. We did 10 acquisitions, multiple rounds of layoffs. So all of that is what gives you judgment and experience over time. So the reason that I've been successful founding companies and building companies afterwards is because every situation you as a CEO bring to me, yeah, I've already seen it. And I you know, no matter how weird it is, you're like, you've never seen this. I'm like, yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it. You know, I had two people, you know, steal money, go to jail at DoubleClick. I mean, the guys in China tried to embezzle data. I mean, just everything, you know, the government suing us. That's what in theory gives you judgment and confidence. You know, hiring so many people, you know, making many brilliant hiring decisions and a bunch of terrible hiring decisions is part of what ideally makes you better over time. Thank you. We have a reunion every year, and generally, you know, 150 people show up. People who worked together 20 years ago, name companies where 20 years later, 150 people will show up to get together. That's very rare. We're still all in touch, and many of us, you know, worked together almost 25 years ago.
Do you play basketball at the reunions?
No, we don't play basketball at the reunions. I think everyone's probably too old now.
We would like to thank Julia Douglas for letting us use her music, juliadouglas2s.com.